Welcome to the Global Research News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman, brought to you by globalresearch.ca, and I'm delighted to have Ellen Brown back on the program. We will have a two-part program today and tomorrow, and we're likely to range through, a number of topics, but the economy is always central. Listeners, I think, are familiar with Ellen, but for the new ones, we always get new ones who don't know much about her. She's a civil litigation attorney, an author, a frequent writer on financial topics, and her latest book, out a few years earlier, but it was updated as of the end of last year, it is really a must-read. I wrote a little bit about it, and we've discussed it, and we surely will discuss it again. It's called Web of Death. It really is a brilliant and very important analysis of the private banking cartel Federal Reserve, how it usurped money creation power, how we can get it back, and a whole lot more. Ellen and I both wrote about Obama's latest, oh my God, everything this guy touches takes a bad situation and makes it worse. So his latest scheme, it's hard to tell what his latest scheme is because he's juggling an awful lot of things in the air at the same time. I guess he's going on national TV about his health care reform that's about as deforming as anything I can imagine. What we know about it, still a work in progress, so final details are a long way from coming out. But he's got a new financial reform package that he has come out with. Oh, it is outrageous. Well, Ellen inspired me to write about it because she wrote about it. And her title is Big Brother in Basel. Everybody knows what Big Brother is. If you don't know what Basel is, it's where the central bank of central bankers is located, called the Bank of International Settlements. And to Ellen, her subtitle, Are We Trading Financial Stability for National Sovereignty? And then I wrote an article that I called Obama's Financial Reform Proposal, a Stealth Scheme for Global Monetary Control. Oh, I see ugly stuff in this plan, and I know Ellen does as well. Ellen, welcome back to the program.
Oh, thanks, Stephen. It's always great to talk to you.
Oh, we have terrific discussions. We could keep this thing going all day. If all the other hosts suddenly come down with the swine flu or something, which doesn't really exist, but we can talk about that as well, maybe later or tomorrow. That would open up the whole day. We could keep this thing going all day. We could take a break to get a glass of water or something and just keep going. But I don't expect that to happen. So we'll talk about the articles. You kick it off. What do you fear in the latest so-called financial reform proposal? I think there's plenty for us to talk about, but you begin.
Right. Well, what I particularly wrote about was something that's buried in the back of the report. It's on page 83 of an 89-page report, and it says that there's a recommendation that the new Financial Stability Board strengthen and institutionalize its mandate to promote global financial stability. So it's a mandate, and it's being institutionalized. Before, the Financial Stability Board grew out of the Financial Stability Forum, which was merely an advisory board to the G7. It was set up in 1999. And then in April, when the G20 met in London, they agreed to this new Financial Stability Board.
Ellen, let me cut you off there because you know what the music means.
Yeah.
We'll take a break, and then you pick it right up when we get back.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
About so-called financial reform, Obama style, and what really looks like consolidating global power. likely taking advantage of the economic crisis situation. And this is generally the way that the power structure gets a chance to frame a problem in terms of this is the fix we propose for it, and then propose a plan that will end up making things far worse than now. But Ellen, you pick up where you left off.
Well, in the president's 89-page proposal, they don't even mention something called the 12 international standards and codes. You have to go to the Bank for International Settlements website to figure out what this Financial Stability Board is really going to do and what it's going to be in charge of. On the there was a press release issued by the Bank for International Settlements that said, as obligations of membership, member countries and territories commit to implement international financial standards. And then in parenthesis, it says, including the 12 key international standards and codes, which aren't defined, but we've just committed to it. We've committed to implementing them. So then you have to go on the Financial Stability Board website, and you can find a list of what these standards are. And they're very broad. They cover everything. So essentially, we're agreeing to have our financial interests regulated by a foreign body in Europe. And now, as part of the G20, we only get one vote, so obviously we're not going to be in control, whether or not we ever were. We may have been at one time. And all that sounds rather reasonable because things have fallen apart globally, and you can see why there might be some good in having coordinated financial standards. But the problem is you have to understand where our whole financial system comes from, that it all emanates out of Germany, right there, with the gnomes of Zurich and Basel, as they're called. Those old world bankers set up the system of privately issued banker money that competed with publicly issued money. And these financial standards and codes allow them to totally squeeze out any form of public money. I mean, they could just say there's one provision about keeping public and private separate. So let's say that these new standards and this new system that we're imposing creates this huge worldwide depression. And somebody realizes there's no reason for this depression. There's no money. And yet what is money? It's just something that the government can issue to pay for things that need to be done. Like Russia is a prime example. They've got every form of raw material you could ask for. They've got all the workers you could ask for, and they've got all the intelligence. They've got engineering know-how and so forth. So they could be building huge roads, all kinds of wonderful infrastructure, but they don't because of a lack of money. Well, what is the money? It's only a medium of exchange. It's only a legal agreement between parties to get together, share things, build something, and then sell whatever it produces, and you know that's what it is, merely a medium of exchange. So it should be a public thing, not a private thing. But now they've managed to corner it privately, totally. This has been a goal for 300 years of that group, and there's a great deal of literature that shows that, most famously going back to the 18th century when Amschel Rothschild, who was the patriarch of the Rothschilds, said, allow me to issue and control a nation's currency, and I care not who makes its laws. The point being, if they could make it look like the government was issuing the currency, but they're actually issuing it and lending it to the government, they would be in control. And then Carol Quigley, who was Bill Clinton's mentor at Georgetown University, wrote a book called Tragedy and Hope, and he was an insider, and he actually approved of their methods, but the one thing he disagreed with it was that he thought it should be made public. So he revealed what their purposes were, and there's this famous line in there that tells what the purpose of the Bank for International Settlements was. He said, the powers of financial capitalism had another far-reaching aim, nothing less than to create a world system of financial control in private hands, able to dominate the political system of each country and the economy of the world as a whole. This system was to be controlled in a feudalistic fashion by the central banks of the world acting in concert by secret agreements arrived at in frequent private meetings and conferences. We obviously have that. The apex of the system was to be the Bank for International Settlements in Basel, Switzerland, a private bank owned and controlled by the world's central banks, which were themselves private corporations. And that goes back to 1966. And the BIS itself was set up in the 30s, and it was very controversial then. We wouldn't join in the 40s because it was reputed to be Hitler's bank laundering gold that he had stolen from other countries. So it's got a very shady history, and the intent ever since it was set up was to make it the private head of this private global system, and now they've done it.
Oh, it really looks, it looks, if they've either done it, Ellen, or they certainly have speeded up the process to doing it, trying to get a stealth plan through the Congress. There's a lot of flack on it. You never know what's going to happen, but these people are never deterred.
Well, that would be my point in writing, is to make sure that somebody notices this, because it was just buried in there, and you wouldn't even know it was an issue. If you read the proposal, you think that the issues are totally something else. Even if you're in Congress with and fighting it, you might not know what to fight, or you might let some provisions pass because you're busily engaged with others, which is a known tactic of that particular group to get us fighting about things that aren't important, like sexual orientation or something like that, and then we forget about the big issues.
Absolutely, Ellen. I mean, how can you get a sick patient? How can you feed a patient? How could you feed a person, to use a human analogy? How do you feed a person medicine if the person isn't sick, and then you convince the person, well, now this is the remedy to make you well again? So we have a sick global economy, and we have this medicine called reform, which actually it's like the vaccinations they want to foist on us that will really cause us more harm. Well, in that case, there's no real problem. So they want to give us a toxic vaccination to cure a non-existent problem. It's absolute madness that they'll scare people to death to take it. There absolutely is a global economic crisis. But they created
it. They created it.
And now they want to create a remedy that will literally let them usurp global power, taking the situation we had before the crisis ever emerged, and giving us something in the name of reform that it may be infinitely worse. Well, you wrote in your colossal book, Web of Debt, and we've sure talked about it, and we will talk about it again on this program. I literally can't get it out of my mind, nor should I. People need to read this book because you explain how they're doing it wrong and how to do it right. Well, if you have private people like the Rothschilds and the Federal Reserve here controlling the nation's money supply, well, we're guaranteed to absolutely get it wrong and harm the public interest. And the solution in this country is to obey the Constitution and let the government control the money supply. And you pointed out that any state can open a state-chartered bank. Well, they can't print money. But you explained to your governor in California that, well, there's an obvious solution to this problem you're screaming your full head off about. Open a state-chartered bank, get deposits in, and the magic of fractional reserve banking will take every buck that's deposited in this bank and magically turn it into 10. Well, voila, economic crisis solved, California solvent again, and if all the other states do the same thing, well, the Federal Reserve might, we might put it in the dustbin of history, Ellen.
Right, or what I would envision actually is that, this is my fantasy, that they've set up all these systems that actually would be good if they were publicly owned. The problem is that they're pulling profits out of it, and that's why we can't, the system is not sustainable, and it is a Ponzi scheme, because they always require more to be paid back than they put out there, and they are private entities that are pulling that money out of the system. So mathematically, it can't be sustained without what's called growth, which means finding more and more people to exploit, or more and more borrowers to pull money out of. But the system itself is actually quite good. I mean, the idea of creating credit and then building things with the credit and then paying back the borrowing with the proceeds of what you created is actually a brilliant idea, and it goes all the way back to the American colonists. It was our original invention. It's just been taken over by a private group. But if we could get that system back, you know, there are two bills in Congress. One is Dennis Kucinich's to nationalize the Federal Reserve, and the other is Ron Paul's to abolish the Federal Reserve. I'd go for nationalizing it. I mean, let them get all the power, or we're not letting them, but it's happening. If all the power goes into the Federal Reserve, we should be able to go to Congress and say, or Congress should be able to say, this needs to be a public entity. And likewise with the banks. And I mean, those banks that collapse, everybody says, well, you can't let them fail. And we'll say, well, true, we're not going to let them fail. We're going to take it over as a public entity, and then we can turn it to good use. And that would solve the whole Ponzi scheme mathematical flaw. If the interest goes back to the center, then you can sustain it. You don't have to continually grow and exploit because you get all the money back. You just keep circulating it.
The solution is so simple, Ellen, but it will never be taken because Wall Street buys the politicians, and that we get the best democracy money can buy, as someone else said. But we'll be right back.
This is RBN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.
Welcome back to the News Hour. On with Ellen Brown, talking about the economic crisis, so-called financial reform. Ellen, it just strikes me. Look, the first thing that I noticed when I took a look at Obama's plan was the idea of giving the Federal Reserve more power. My goodness, it almost brought up my breakfast to even think about something like that. That's reform. My God, the problems that we're in really lay right at the heart of Fed policies. And the Fed, more than any other central bank, but the others that have done horrible things too, Bank of England, the European Central Bank, and I guess Japan kind of goes along with anything the other big boys want to do. And then the idea of consolidating power into the hands. You mentioned the G20. They had an April meeting, but the real power lies in the hands of the G7 and a half a dozen countries. They control this central bank of central bankers, the BIS, Bank of International Settlements. And then you bring the IMF into the picture, the World Bank, the other major international lending agencies. The idea of giving these global financial institutions supreme global power. Oh, my goodness. You mentioned Orwell was 25 years too early. Could he ever imagine something on a global scale as horrible as this? I'm not sure he could have.
Well, he did imagine it, and that may be where there's some evidence that, there was this incident where the Queen of England gave the President of Mexico a couple of months ago, 1984, Orwell's book, as a gift, which was a very strange choice of gift. But the President of Mexico he basically stole the earth. He's alleged to have stole the election from the opponents and repressed it very forcefully, and so he's definitely following the model of Big Brother. So who knows? But I want to say one more thing on the Financial Stability Board. Even if we get one vote out of 20, somebody might think, well, that's fine. That's only fair. We should let the rest of the world have a vote. But the thing is, there's no structure to it. We aren't guaranteed any kind of a vote on anything. If we're going to be a member of a body that is in control of the economy globally, it needs to, at the very least, be set up like our American system of checks and balances. We need something in the nature of a Congress. Right now, you have these 12 different standards that are determined and enforced by committee. Well, where do these committee members come from, and who appoints them, and who controls them if they get out of line? That you need some sort of checks and balances where we elect a representative, some representatives, and our representatives get a say in anything that happens. I mean, this is looking far in the future. Hopefully, we wouldn't have such a board at all. But if we're going to join such a board, we can't just allow ourselves to become subject to something that has no democratic structure at all. It's totally top-down, big brotherish, very big brotherish.
And you mentioned that to get for this country to agree to anything as momentous as this, we should be talking about a treaty, which the Constitution
right.
talks about, and the Senate should have ratification authority, and this thing should be thoroughly vetted and discussed and debated. I mean, you don't rush through something. You remember, and you've written about, and I've written a little as well, when the Federal Reserve Act went through in 1913, is absolutely the worst piece of legislation, I think, in world history, maybe up until right now, if this god-awful thing ever goes through. But it was presented to Congress 2 days before Christmas. A lot of the members had already left. Nobody read the darn thing. And they just rammed it through in the middle of the night. And as you pointed out, I never read the act, but as you pointed out, if anybody read it, including somebody, a lawyer like yourself, the language is so benign, you'd have no idea just how awful this thing was or what they really had in mind. So they wrote up this financial proposal with the same kind of benign language that sounds so wonderful. We have a problem. We're going to fix it and do A, B, C, D, E, or whatever. And you can pretty much know that they have some pretty evil intentions. But they're clever, and they don't want you to know about it, so they hide it.
They won't act on it right away. For instance, the tax code was put in 1913 at the same time, and nobody paid any attention to it, really, because it was very short, and very few people were covered and it was a very low tax rate, so it was no big deal. And then it just sat there for a number of years, and it was actually in World War II where it got bigger and bigger. It was sort of your patriotic duty to contribute to this war effort. And so, and at that point, they could point back and say, well, we've had this law on the books for 30 years, so you can't exactly say it's not any good. And in fact, when it's been challenged lately on not having been ratified properly, that's the 16th Amendment, the judges said, well, the Attorney General looked at it at the time, and it's too late now. It's a moot point. So that's what they'll do, is they'll allow this board to go through, and then it'll just sit there and not do much of anything for a long time till we get used to the idea that it's there, and then suddenly they'll act and we won't have any leverage.
And that noted President Woodrow Wilson, after he signed the act and he knew exactly what he was doing, he said, "I ruined my country." Did he ever? I hope he's in the deep bowels of hell for what he did. But we'll be right back.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Because you can handle the truth.
Hour on with Ellen Brown, talking about all things economic. Ellen, can I bring another element into the conversation? That article that you alerted me to yesterday, the Harry Schultz prediction. Market Watch, the financial site, picked up the article by Peter Brimelow, and they posted it. I don't spot the date. I think within the last day or so. And the top line of the article reads, the top performing letter, investing letter they mean, the top performing letter that predicted the crash of 2008 now predicts a confiscatory Franklin D. Roosevelt style bank holiday. And you mentioned to me an August September surprise. My goodness, Harry Schultz is the guy who puts this out. I think he's been in the business 40 years or so. Apparently, his stock market performance isn't as good as his overall predictions. Mm-hmm. But talk of a big dollar devaluation, the way I like to phrase it, turning your dollars into quarters or dimes, and great problems if something like this happens. I guess this would add fuel to the economic crisis. Well, my goodness, maybe the fact that somebody wrote about this will head it off at the pass if this is what they have in mind. But this is just something else that would be terrible. Everybody going along merrily thinking, well, you know, the worst of the crisis is over and we're just kind of, we may be bumping along the bottom, but the best is still to come ahead, so just be patient. And then wham, we get hit in the late summer with something like this if it happens. And what will happen if this happens? Do you think it may, Ellen?
Certainly September is when they do seem to plan things, right around the September 11th date. But one of the reasons that this is predicted is that other countries are not buying dollars for their reserves and they're loading up on local currencies. Well, to me, that's actually a good thing, and I think that's a stabilizing thing. I don't see that as something that would prompt a bank holiday, I mean, that would bring down the banks. That's what they should do. Governments should be issuing their local currencies and doing local development, and the governments themselves should issue them. As for us, feeling that we absolutely have to have these foreign investors to buy our debt, we don't. There is another alternative, and it's being done now, which is to buy or to sell our bonds to our own Federal Reserve, our own central bank, which the beauty of that is that the Federal Reserve rebates the interest after they deduct their costs back to the government. So it actually is that sort of closed system that the American colonists had that actually worked, where the bank is the government. It's a government-owned bank. Of course, the Federal Reserve is not government-owned, and that's a problem, and that's what I'm going to keep beating the drums about to try to – it should be federally owned. But it is a captive bank in the sense that they are forced to rebate their profits. So at least in that sense, when the government funds its debt through the Federal Reserve, it's essentially getting interest-free money. And because the debt is never paid off, that's it basically is our money supply. It's not even really a loan. It's really just money that goes out there. Now, everybody thinks that's highly inflationary, and they're all alarmed because of all the monetizing that the Federal Reserve is doing of debt, not just of the governments. I think it's great that they're doing the governments, but of course they're monetizing all kinds of other things that are much more dubious. But they're also stepping in and acting where the banks have failed, which is a good thing. But the reason it's not inflationary, I wrote an article on that too, is that a huge amount of lending has disappeared. These are called the shadow lenders. It used to be that all those mortgages were bundled up and sold off as securities to banks around the world and the Chinese and everybody else. And those were the ones that were bundles of subprime loans that were sold off as AAA because they were protected supposedly with these derivatives. Well, it turned out the derivatives were no good because they weren't really insurance because there's no insurance commissioner to make sure that the parties supposedly guaranteeing the risk or assuming the risk in the event of default actually had the money to pay up, and they don't. So when everybody figured that out, they quit buying these collateralized debt obligations, which were those bundles of mortgages protected with securities. So that market has gone away, like evaporated. The collateralized debt obligation market is gone. And those shadow lenders, as they're called, composed 40% of the mortgage market. So that all those lenders are gone. So the Federal Reserve, even the amount of quantitative easing, as they say, or monetizing of debt that they've done, stepping in and just creating money on their books and lending it, is not as much as the loans that have disappeared. And all of our money consists of loans. That's all there is out there, except coins, which are almost nothing. So our whole money system is a debt system, and when loans go away, the money goes away, and that's what a depression is. It's when there's not enough money to keep the system running. It's not that we lack the materials or the workers or anything. We only lack the money, which is an artificial construct that can be generated publicly and should be to fill the gap.
So in an economy the way like we have now, an economy on the decline, falling GDP and so on, it's hard to get inflation when the scenario you laid out is actually what's happening. You also point out in Web of Debt, and I think one of your articles that you mentioned Weimar Germany as an example, and what really created the hyperinflationary situation there was the terrible shorting of the German Deutschmark. So it was attacked. I mean, it was attacked. So, I mean, it was attacked, and the attack worked. It just destroyed it, created this terrible hyperinflation. I don't think Germany – well, Germany was wrecked because of the Versailles Treaty. Before that, the attack on the currency began, I don't know how dire the – I guess the economy of Germany had to be dire while the rest of the world was basking in the euphoria of the 1920s. But it was that attack on the currency that caused so much problem. Well, I guess if the powers that be, Ellen, wanted to attack the U.S. dollar to destroy it, who knows what these people have in mind. I guess they could create hyperinflation here, too. But apparently they have other things on their mind. So there could be a serious inflation program problem in the future. But it certainly does not look like it's going to be coming in the nearer term, the next year or 2 years or 3 years, unless there's a drastic change in policy.
Right. Well, and the inflation is not going to be from the Federal Reserve issuing loans. It's merely stepping in to issue loans in place of the banks that haven't been doing it. If there is hyperinflation, like you say, what hyperinflation really is, it always is, it involves foreign exchange. It's always because your currency has been trashed by the powers that be, as you say. Well, who are these powers that be? Those are the gnomes of Zurich, as they're called. Those are those bankers behind closed doors who are pulling strings, who have huge amounts of money, and that can shift it from one place to the other, and have been known to do that. In 1998, the Asian crisis was orchestrated massive short selling of those Asian currencies, and the actual there's evidence that the idea was to bring down those countries. Japan was doing much too well, and the other Asian countries. And the one they couldn't bring down was China, because China had not opened up its currency. It wasn't freely exchangeable like the others. And so China survived and thrived. And another one that survived and thrived was Malaysia, because they quit doing the they cut off the ability of the speculators to speculate in their currency. It seems to me the dollar will not be trashed because all those other countries hold the dollar, and so they have a vested interest in not seeing it go down, which is very clever of us, I guess, to get them to hold our money. It's rather like how the big banks and big corporations have gotten us to buy their stock. 50% of the country now owns stock in the stock market. So everybody feels they have a vested interest in seeing the stock market stay up. So we don't worry if we hear rumors of manipulation or whatever. We think, oh, we're good. At least they're holding the stock market up, which is actually very bad. I mean, it's total control. It's corrupt. It is not the free market that we think that we have. All these free marketers are promoting the wrong thing.
Well, it's not a free market at all. And on the 1st of July, Ellen, Michael Hudson will be back. He talked about how our system forces other central banks to recycle their dollars to U.S. treasuries, because we simply won't allow so many countries to buy into our industries. I guess our close G7 partners, UK or Germany, whatever, they can invest in U.S. companies. But we're not too happy about countries like China or Russia or Brazil or so many others, India, buying up U.S. industry so they control it. It's okay for our companies to buy up their industry so that we control theirs. So the only alternative they have with all these dollars that they get hold of is to recycle them back into U.S. treasuries. And Hudson has a Project Censored award-winning article this year on the idea that a lot of this recycling of dollars goes to funding our militarism around the world, whether it's U.S. military bases or foreign wars and occupations. I mean, this is just a horrible system, and we get these other countries to supply us with all of this funding so the Treasury can keep issuing debt ad infinitum. And Hudson has always also pointed out, I think you also, that no country ever repays its debt. And a country as indebted as we are, Ellen, I mean, it's impossible to ever repay this thing. In Web of Debt, you pointed out, the only time we've been debt-free was under Andrew Jackson. Want to tell that story?
Mm-hmm. Well, the federal debt is our money supply, and because it's the nature of our money supply that it consists of credit, and ordinary private loans get paid off eventually. So if that's all you had was private loans, in theory, they could all be paid off, and you would have no money out there. So the one party that keeps borrowing and doesn't have to pay it back is the federal government. And so it borrows more and more, and that money goes out into the system. And because those loans are never paid back, then that money continues to circulate in the system, and that is our money supply. And because of the nature of this Ponzi scheme that is the debt and credit system to private lenders, the money supply has to continually to grow to cover the interest on all the money they create as loans. They always require more to be paid back than they put out. So somewhere, somebody has to continually be taking out new loans, and to supply that money, the ultimate source of money would be the federal government borrowing yet more money. There was, for instance, in the 40s, they had the money to pay off some debt, but they couldn't do it because if they did, they would have collapsed the money supply or shrunk the money supply. So they have to keep that debt out there because that's the nature of our money supply. But what you could do, because acknowledging that that's our money supply, is pay off those bonds with dollars that you print. You can't. There's no way that we, the taxpayers, are going to come up with $11 trillion. And you can't borrow your way out of debt. Those are the only two options we have right now are either to hit up the taxpayers or to borrow. So in that system, there is no way to get out of debt. You're always going to go further and further into debt. But if you acknowledge that it's the sovereign right of a government to create the national money supply of that country, you can, and all our debts are in dollars. So if we own the Federal Reserve, we could print the dollars to pay off the debts as they come due. They always do that. They always do pay off the bonds as they come due. The thing is, they then roll the bonds over with yet more debt. So what you could do is pay them off in the ordinary way with dollars. But this time, don't lend them to anyone else. Just say, we're not issuing any more bonds. We're now going to fund our own government. And either what you could do is, if you want to keep the books looking nice, you could borrow from your own Federal Reserve, interest-free, say, or you could just issue the money, but then you have to be very careful how much you're going to issue it, because you don't want it. One thing about a debt is that, at least in theory, it will get paid back, so it's more balanced than just issuing money and issuing money. That was a problem they had in the colonies. But, yeah, Andrew Jackson paid it off because he was annoyed at the bank and pulled all the money out of the banks, or of the central bank, which he got shut down, and put it into state banks.
The Bank of the United States at that time, not a Federal Reserve. We didn't have a Federal Reserve in those days, but the privately operated Bank of the United States. And Andrew Jackson was one of the few brave souls as president. A lot of other things about him we could certainly criticize, but as far as I'm concerned, he's an iconic figure for telling the private bank of the United States to go to hell. And
he was so colorful. You have to love the story. He uses great colorful language about the hydra-headed monster.
Hydra-headed monster. Aren't there also stories that there were numerous failed attempts to assassinate him?
Two, yep. And he went, the gun didn't fire or something.
The gun didn't fire?
Or he missed. I've forgotten. Yeah.
it's a very hazardous undertaking to go against the power of the big bank. I think the big bankers, more than anybody else, the bankers controlling the money supply. There's no greater power in the world than controlling the money supply. It's like controlling the breath in our lungs or the blood in our veins. Countries can't function without a way to run their economies. And at least in this day and age, they run on money or debt, and whoever controls that really controls the whole system. So the big bankers certainly run everything, and the heart of the problem is really this, and the solution to the problem is to take back our power to create money and use it productively. And you point out, Helen, in Web of Debt, that we can create publicly created money. You can create as much of it as you want, provided it's put to productive use, and you can do it inflation-free, and you can do it without the need for an income tax, and we could have a healthy, sustainable, growing economy, full employment, my goodness, a near utopia, economic utopia compared to the alternative that we've lived under for decades and decades. But that is not good for the Wall Street bankers, so we don't have it. We have the terrible system we have now.
Well, they're fighting and fighting to preserve the old system. They keep calling it change, but it's really not. What they're doing is trying to prop up an old, failed system. And the only good of that is eventually, it seems to me, it's going to be obvious that all this propping up just isn't working. And hopefully there'll be so much disagreement that they can't pass this stuff. And then they'll have to look around for some other actual change, like an actually better solution.
We'll be right back.
This is RVN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.
Welcome back to the News Hour, final segment with Ellen Brown. Ellen will be back for part two tomorrow. And let me just point out that Ellen has two websites. The one relevant to today is webofdebt.com, the title of her book, Web of Debt. And Ellen has another website, Ellen Brown, two L's, of course, ellenbrown.com. And Ellen has written 11 books, including books on health-related issues, natural healing. And I think listeners probably don't know, Ellen, that you had a best-selling book that you co-authored with a Dr. Lynn Walker titled Nature's Pharmacy. And maybe we can talk some health issues tomorrow. We're near the end of the program today, but the possibility that we could have mandatory vaccinations in our future. Natural health solutions as opposed to toxic drugs sounds pretty good to me.
Mm-hmm. I think we could solve the whole medical crisis. The problem is we're insuring the wrong stuff. We're insuring things that are extremely expensive, and they're actually making people sicker. But because all those studies are controlled, those studies are very corrupt. They've gotten worse and worse. I've talked to people that have actually dealt with these drug company studies, and they're privately done, so they're you can buy them. You can buy results. And so you can't trust any of them anymore. Our book, Nature's Pharmacy, actually came out in 1998, and it was on the market for 2 years and published by Prentice Hall, and it sold 285,000 copies. And then Prentice Hall closed their doors because they were beaten out by Amazon. It was Prentice Hall Direct, their mail order division. And so we were always going to update it, but I mentioned to a dentist who I also wrote a book with that we hadn't, you know, our studies were a bit old, and that's why we hadn't reissued it. And he said, no, he said, the studies before 1998 were, you could rely on those. He said, but the recent studies are absolutely unreliable because many of them have been corrupted. And what they're measuring in these studies is not right. They're, for instance, on cancer chemotherapy, which is probably the worst, they're not allowed to compare it to a control group that gets natural remedies. That's considered not humane or not ethical to not give the one group drugs because they might die. So what they compare it to is the last drug that was approved by the FDA or some similar drug, and they say, well, this one will make you live 3 days longer or something like that on average. But still, it's not really extending life. I mean, so you live 3 years past your cancer or something. That's not very long. So the whole standard is of the FDA is a drug must be safe and effective for its intended purpose. Well, the intended purpose is wrong. Like, what if the intended purpose is to shrink tumors? But what if the tumor is there to protect the body from this growth that would otherwise invade the body? Now, if you hit that tumor with radiation, there are good studies showing that radiation actually shortens life. And here's the reason. You've put a toxic thing into you. I mean, the radiation is obviously bad for your whole body. It's killed the immune system. And so the body has let go of that tumor because it no longer has the energy there to wall off this dangerous growth. So then it spreads into other parts of the body.
Ellen, let me stop you there because they'll cut away very shortly. Oh, I think we have intrigued listeners to come back tomorrow to listen to part two. Can we continue this tomorrow?
Oh, sure.
Oh, this is a terrific subject. We're talking about financial health on the one hand and human health on the other. Join us again tomorrow. Ellen, my great thanks for a terrific discussion.
Oh, thank you.
And more to come tomorrow. Please join us then.
Okay.